Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about, I think, quite an interesting book, quite an important book, published by Cambridge University Press, Between Immunity and Impunity, External Accountability for Political Elites for Transnational Crime, which does a whole bunch of things and asks some quite interesting questions about high-level public officials and kind of what they can and can't do and by whose rules. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the book, Dr. Yulia Zabolina, to tell us all about it. Yulia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Aranda, for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself to our audience a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Absolutely. Well, my name is Yulia Zabolina. I'm currently associate professor with the University of Alabama here in the United States. I originally come from Ukraine, and I grew up in Ukraine in the 1990s. And in my childhood and the former years, I witnessed systemic injustices, violence, people's insecurity, and economic desperation. I was too young to understand the meaning of injustice back then, obviously, and I was not interested in organized crime. I just saw some men wearing black leather jackets and looking fearful, looking very aggressive and prepared and protective of their territory. And as I said, back in the day, I was just observing those things. And then my life took me to places. I was lucky to complete my education in different parts of Europe. And then I moved and got started with a professional research/teaching career in the United States. And this is where my interest in the topic of organized crime developed. But on the side of organized crime research, I've always been interested in political power. So when it was time for me to choose the topic for my research, I decided that it would be a nice combination to put together organized crime and my research interest in political elites and political institutions. There's not so much research in criminology that looks at elite deviance, at the crimes of the powerful, for a good reason, to be honest. Many criminologists are probably scared to find reliable data on these topics. There's always a risk that powerful individuals can sue you in court for defamation or libel issues. So writing about political elites, particularly from the point of view of their crimes, is by far not an easy topic. But I'm not. I'm very much interested to pursue this topic, and that's what led me to the book project that we will be discussing within the next hour or so with you, Miranda.
Thank you for that backstory. I always find it really interesting to hear how people come to write books, because it is quite often sort of the combination of things. It's never just one thing. It's kind of going, ooh, this and this and this, let's see what happens. So thank you for telling us about the strands that fed into this one. Can you tell us a bit more about kind of how that evolved, what questions you ended up deciding to ask in the book, and how you decided on these?
Yes. So the book raises what I believe are pivotal questions about economic crimes committed by high-ranking public officials. I'm not really looking at human rights violations or crimes against humanity. There's quite a lot of literature on that topic. So I wanted to fill in the niche on economic crimes. How do high-ranking public officials get richer and richer and by committing terrible crimes that cause harms on a large scale to societies, to the people of the country, and to the international criminal justice system? So these questions reflect on the complex interplay between elite deviance, transnational organized crime, and the legal mechanisms of impunity that often protect high-ranking public officials from being held accountable for their crimes in foreign jurisdictions. So I pretty much hypothesize is that if political elites, criminal political elites, deviant political elites are powerful, and well established in the political system in country A, country A is not really likely to take any legal steps to prosecute those individuals just because they are in so, they have so much control and power. So I'm looking at foreign jurisdictions and whether the, and that's what we say external accountability. It's the word in the title. So I'm looking at whether foreign jurisdiction can take action against foreign political elites involved in economic crime. So this is the questions. And obviously, as we most of the audience probably know, public officials in high level positions in any country are usually protected by immunity. Immunity is there to allow public officials to do the job that they're meant to do, right? Without interference, without threats, without risks, without intimidation. So that's the idea of immunity. So one of the central questions the book confronts is how do international legal frameworks address or fail to address the immunity of high-ranking public officials in cases of transnational crimes. Transnational crime is usually a profit-oriented crime, according to the United Nations Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime. So this question builds on the gap between the ideals of international law and its real world applications, particularly how legal norms can be manipulated to shield the powerful from accountability. And then countries end up with political leaders from developing countries officially making minuscule incomes with most modest public salaries. But miraculously, they can afford high-end properties and luxury goods in most expensive foreign cities like London or New York. And understanding this discrepancy, in my opinion, highlights the limitations of current international legal frameworks and point towards necessary reforms to ensure that legal protections like immunity from foreign jurisdiction afforded to public officials do not become instruments of impunity and oppression. Mm. Yeah. So that's a kind of the book in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very helpful to have it in a nutshell like that. There's obviously a whole host of things you've mentioned that I'm going to ask you to tell us about in more detail. But I appreciate both clarifying the questions as well as kind of the stakes, right? Why is this so important to investigate? So as we continue going into more detail about the book, obviously in that answer, you mentioned a number of things, one of which is the term elite deviance. Can you tell us a bit more about this and how you conceptualize it?
Yes, absolutely. And I could probably spend the entire time allocated for this interview just discussing the concept of elite deviance, because it's very complicated. And as I said, there is quite some literature on the topic, much of it from the 80s, and not so much actually from the more recent time periods. Elite deviance is associated with crimes of individuals who are in positions that wield significant authority and influence. The other terms that are synonymous with elite deviance would be crimes of the powerful, crimes committed by political elites, deviant elites. So there are many similar expressions out there. Elite deviance is not the only concept. The essence is that positions in public offices afford individuals not only considerable control over resources and decision making, but also the capacity to shape norms, policies, and outcomes at various societal levels, including in the government. Building on the work of criminologists like Sutherland and Chambliss, the book recognizes that elite deviance is not merely the product of individual malfeasance, but is often rooted in and perpetuated by broader systemic and structural conditions leading to state-organized crime. This is Chambliss's term, state-organized crime. The book recognizes that elite deviance or state-organized crime is an important criminological topic. Believe it or not, criminology has always dealt with the topic of elite deviance as a marginal topic. So most criminologists look at street crimes, regular crimes, issues of policing, but very, very frequently any any attention of criminal political elites is not there in criminology. Political science has advanced some knowledge on deviant political elites, but as you probably understand, crime is not the main topic for political scientists. So again, deviant or elite deviants would be a side issue, a side matter in political science research.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful to kind of map out where this fits within some of the literatures. So thank you for clarifying that. Moving on to another kind of piece of the nutshell that I'd like us to discuss further. Obviously, the idea of international immunity is quite key here to kind of understand what exactly it is and therefore how it's being used or misused. So can you walk us through some of the conceptual, doctrinal, and theoretical foundations for this principle?
Sure. And as with the previous question, there's quite a lot of literature on this topic. So my response will be quite brief. And I hope that the audience of this interview will be able to get a copy of the book and get into more details. But I'm happy to summarize some of the main foundations for international immunities from the point of law. The conceptual, the doctrinal, and theoretical foundation for international immunities are rooted in the principles of sovereignty, equality of states, and the need for effective diplomatic relations and international cooperation. These foundations are firmly established in international treaty law and customary practice of states. At the core of international immunities or immunities of public officials from foreign jurisdiction is the principle of state sovereignty, as I mentioned already. This principle holds that each state has exclusive authority over its territory, and each state is equal to every other state in the international system. Immunities are granted to ensure that one state does not infringe upon the sovereignty of another state by subjecting that state's representatives to the former's jurisdiction. This being said, the understanding is that immunity belongs to the state and not to its public officials, not to its representatives. Therefore, it is the right of the state to grant or revoke any immunity its officials enjoy abroad or domestically, for that matter. But the book only looks at how immunities come into play abroad from the point of view of external accountability. A related doctrine here is the doctrine of reciprocity and comity in international relations. Those two ensure that states grant immunities to each other's officials based on mutual understanding and benefit. So, and that's a very common practice. In fact, in several of the cases I looked at, in the immunity claimed by a public official was not rejected by the litigating court because of reciprocity, and the judges were making statements that we want our diplomats to be treated in the same way in foreign countries. So surprisingly or not, reciprocity and comity remain until today important principles of diplomatic and foreign relations, and they form a strong foundation for how immunities operate today. Of relevance is, of course, the functional necessity theory. It's a very popular theory in diplomatic studies, diplomatic relations, and it's very frequently discussed in that specific context, in the context of diplomatic immunity, as opposed to immunity of heads of state or ministers of foreign affairs. So this functional necessity theory underpins the reasoning that officials of foreign states and international organizations, for that matter, must be granted certain immunities to perform their duties effectively without intervention, persecution, and the like.
I wonder if we can talk more about something you mentioned in that answer, kind of immunities plural. What are the different types of foreign official immunities?
Well, what are the different types of foreign officials, right? So immunities are only afforded to high-ranking officials. That's kind of what the general consensus agreement is in the international legal system. So definitely head of state immunity, right? And then ministers of foreign affairs also are protected by immunity. There's also diplomatic immunity and consular immunity. So immunity is afforded in diplomatic relations. But the list is not conclusive. So we have some ideas based on court cases and customary practices, and also on treaty law. So we have the Convention on Diplomatic Relations of 1961. So it's one of the foundational treaties that establishes diplomatic immunities and other things, of course. But also there is a customary practice. So head of state immunity is regulated by customary law. So that's quickly about what public officials are out there and who of them can have foreign official immunities. But the story is a little bit more complicated than that, because obviously the audience in this conversation needs to understand that some immunities are active, current officials, and some officials may be actually former officials. So they either retired, moved to a different job, things like that, right? But if they committed a crime, some countries may still have an interest in prosecuting them for the crimes committed in the past. And their immunity may pop up as an issue, as a problem before the court could proceed with the charges. So, as already highlighted, the concept of foreign official immunities in international law is primarily designed to ensure that representatives of states can perform their official duties without interference from the judiciary of foreign nations in the context of the book. There are two primary types of foreign official immunities in international law, other than the different types afforded to different public officials. So the main types that I want to discuss now are personal immunities, immunities that ratione persona in Latin, or functional immunity, immunity ratione materiae. Personal immunities are granted to high-ranking officials such as heads of state, head of government, foreign ministers, and senior diplomats. It is a status immunity. In fact, sometimes it's called like this, status immunity, that attaches to office. The central feature of this immunity is that it provides complete, and I want to emphasize this again, complete protection from jurisdiction in foreign states for both official acts or acts undertaken in a personal capacity while the official is in office. The rationale behind personal immunities is to safeguard the dignity and function of the offices that are integral to the operation of a state and its interactions on the international stage. Therefore, personal immunity is usually not extended to senior public officials who have no role to play in international relations. So like, I don't know, Minister of Interior, for instance. Usually ministers of interior do not have any personal immunities because in their mandate, they're not really participating in any foreign relations. Once these officials leave their positions, leave their offices, they no longer enjoy personal immunities for their private acts, although their official acts carried out during their tenure remain immune from foreign jurisdiction. Just to summarize, personal immunities protect heads of state, heads of government, foreign ministers, and senior diplomats for both official and private acts, but only through a short period while those officials are in office. Functional immunities, as opposed to personal immunities, apply to individuals based on the acts they perform rather than their position or status. These immunities are granted to state officials for acts executed in their official capacity. Unlike personal immunities, functional immunities are not tied to the tenure of the official in their official positions, and they extend beyond their term in office, covering only those acts that are considered part of the official duties. So any kind of acts of corruption or drug trafficking that would not really fall into functional immunities because they are not official acts. Even though the book looks into cases when suspects of crime, defendants, were making statements in court that if drug drugs were moved, they were actually part of the state mission because state instrumentalities and state resources were involved. So it should fall under the immunity clause, which did not really go much far in litigation. And it was recognized by most courts that those acts are not official acts. So the purpose of functional immunity is to ensure that state functions and operations are not impeded by foreign judicial processes, but they usually do not apply to any acts that we cannot see as official acts, even though, as I said, it could be a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually in that sort of gray area that I'd like to ask you to talk through a sort of type of act, because it does sort of speak to this and goes back to the point you made earlier about how this book helps us understand the gap between sort of the ideal of international law and what actually happens. So one of the examples you discuss in the book is the exploitation of domestic workers in the households of foreign officials. How does this help us understand this gray area and problems with international immunity law?
Mm-hmm. Indeed, exploitation of migrant domestic workers in foreign diplomats' households has been frequently discussed in the context of trafficking in persons and elite deviants. Domestic workers have been alleged to be subjected to terrible exploitative labor conditions by diplomats and their household members, which often intertwine with sex abuse in some cases that are looked at. Diplomatic immunity, intended to facilitate the smooth conduct of international relations, can sometimes shield foreign officials from legal accountability in host countries, even in cases involving serious crimes like human trafficking and labor exploitation. Because as you remember from what I said a few minutes ago, if somebody is protected with personal immunity, that immunity covers officials and private acts. So while the diplomat is in office, that pretty much could cover sexual abuse and violations of labor rights of domestic workers. So victimized migrant domestic workers often face significant barriers in seeking justice, including fear of retaliation, fear of deportation, lack of legal awareness, lack of knowledge about their rights, and obviously the lack of understanding how diplomatic protection works and what can be done with it. So even when cases are brought to attention, the host country's authorities might be powerless to intervene directly due to the constraints, legal constraints and protections of immunity laws, if we're talking about sitting diplomats protected with personal immunity. In one of the early cases that I looked at, and we are going back to 1999 here, when the problem was only beginning to be discussed, when the problem only began to be visible to relevant circles and relevant agencies, a Bangladeshi woman claimed she had been enslaved by the second secretary of the Bahrain mission to the United Nations in New York City and his wife. After signing a contract in which she agreed to work for the household as a domestic servant, she stated her passport was confiscated by the couple and she was left to care for their children and perform household duties that held her in near absolute involuntary servitude. In response, the defendants claim to be protected by diplomatic immunity that makes serving diplomats exempt from the jurisdiction of foreign courts. Although the case was eventually settled for an undisclosed amount of damages that the Bahraini couple paid to the domestic worker, there has never been a formal sentence, recognition of guilt against the alleged offenders. So this case kind of shows the complexity and some of the possible solutions. So out-of-court settlements has become a real issue, an opportunity for domestic workers to get some damages, to get some justice, right? But from the point of view of legal scholarship and also criminology, definitely out-of-court settlements do not represent this 100% justice that could be a satisfactory solution in cases like I just described. So throughout the years of practice, some other accountability mechanisms, albeit imperfect, have been developed. So first, of course, sentenced states can opt to waive the immunity of the officials accused of serious crimes, like trafficking in persons. So pretty much the state needs to make the stamp, we revoke the immunity of the officials accused of trafficking in persons, so that the foreign court involved in the case would be able to prosecute. But you will be surprised. According to my analysis, this has not happened a lot by far. So I guess it's a matter of state of government's reputation on the international arena. They just don't like waiving immunity of their representatives. So that's not really common. In the other opportunities that diplomatic agents alleged to have victimized their domestic servants could be prosecuted when they are no longer in the office, right? Going back to functional immunity. So we can, because they're in office, we cannot prosecute them. But if their mandate is done, then they only have residual immunity, this functional immunity, and they will only be protected for official acts. And trafficking in persons is obviously not an official act, even though there were arguments made, oh, she worked at diplomatic parties, official parties, official receptions, right? So it was, so that was an official act on the person of prosecuted diplomat. So in a few U.S. and U.K. cases like Svarna versus Alvadi in the United States illustrate critical judicial interventions where the courts determine that the mistreatment or exploitation of domestic workers does not fall under official diplomatic acts. So once diplomats leave office, they can be prosecuted, right? And yeah, and I want to mention one case, and again, I don't want to bore the audience here with too many details, but there was one important case, one landmark case prosecuted in the UK just a few years ago, and the UK's approach in recognizing labor exploitation as a commercial activity is a breakthrough here, and I'm talking about Basva versus Vong. It represents a progressive step towards limiting the scope of diplomatic immunity. So a few maybe highlights here or accents here. The diplomatic immunity, according to the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, Article 31, has an exception for commercial activity. So pretty much the convention says that diplomatic immunity covers the diplomat eligible to be covered by this immunity, except for cases of commercial activity, like when a diplomat runs a business or provides consultancy services or things like that. So what the British court claimed is that, oh, human trafficking constitutes a commercial activity exception. So, and the U.S. courts have continuously, repeatedly rejected that position. And the U.K. court made a breakthrough, in my opinion. The reason in here is that trafficking in persons, as per the definition included in the UN Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, is nothing but a crime that pursues financial and other material benefit, an inherently profit-oriented activity. So yeah, so this case is definitely a breakthrough, and thank you for giving me a chance to highlight it a little bit more in this conversation.
No, I'm very glad you did. Thank you for taking us through that one as part of kind of the overall answer on the topic. It's really interesting to hear how this, on this particular issue, kind of the cases have evolved and presumably will keep evolving. But I'd like to move to another sort of area of gray area in terms of kind of international law and how it works in practice. You mentioned right at the beginning, kind of one of the impetuses for investigating this question is the idea of amassing personal wealth. So can we talk about how these immunity laws enable foreign officials to do this and what sorts of solutions are being attempted to mitigate or prevent it?
Mm-hmm. Well, corruption is a part and parcel of elite deviance groups or rich political elites. Obviously, we're talking about individuals with lots of wealth, and wealth always comes with power, and wealth can be used to promote, to fund electoral campaigns and perpetuate control over political institutions in the country of origin of individuals. There's quite a lot of literature on that. Usually those individuals would be called kleptocrats. So So kleptocrats would be political elites stealing money, usually from the state or otherwise, and accumulating illicit profits in usually in foreign bank accounts because for several reasons. They do that because they can enjoy the money when they travel, but get better access to luxury goods. And also in that way, money is safe because it's far away, right? And it's difficult to find. So immunity provisions can be exploited to facilitate the cross-border movement of this illicit funds. Kleptocrats might use diplomatic channels which are less susceptible to scrutiny by law enforcement or even financial institutions to transfer stolen assets internationally. Sometimes, in fact, diplomatic communication can be used for simple bulk cash smuggling, right? And because diplomatic bags cannot be open, well, then you understand. It's easy to understand. If you cannot open a bag and get to know what's inside, anything can be brought in diplomatic bags or diplomatic pouches. When kleptocrats secure assets in foreign jurisdictions, their immunity status can complicate international efforts or the efforts of a foreign country to seize and possibly repatriate these assets, even when the illicit origins are clearly known. The protections afforded by immunity can also obstruct investigations into corrupt activities, making it more challenging for foreign authorities to gather evidence, prosecute individuals, or even question individuals, interrogate individuals with the immunity status, because that may be considered intervention into the foreign affairs, into the domestic affairs of a foreign state. Some of the solutions being tried to mitigate or prevent kleptocratic political elites include targeted sanctions and visa restrictions against individuals suspected of corruption and usually gross human rights abuses. Because targeted sanctions are administrative and not punitive instruments, the predominant interpretation among scholars and practitioners today is that targeted sanctions do not breach the protections provided by foreign official immunity. And I think it's a smart way to think about sanctions, that it's not a punishment. So we're not punishing individuals complicit or accused of corruption or other crimes. So targeted sanctions has become an attractive mechanism of response to elite deviants. Other responses employed have focused on transparency in financial transactions and beneficial ownership, such as the implementation of the Financial Action Task Force recommendations, which aim to make it more difficult for kleptocrats to hide the dirty assets abroad. Of importance is also in rem, in kind confiscations. This legal mechanism is quite a breakthrough. It allows authorities to seize assets involved in or derived from criminal activity without necessarily convicting the owner of the assets. So in other words, in rem confiscations are crucial for asset recovery efforts, allowing states to seize and repatriate assets without prosecuting the kleptocrats, only focusing on the loot, on the dirty money. A notable case in this regard illustrates the intersection of international immunity laws and kleptocratic practices, featuring Obiang Mangu, the vice president of the vice president of Equatorial Guinea, and the son of the country's president. Obiang Mangu has been subjected to in rem confiscations in the United States and stood at trial in absentia on charges of embezzlement, money laundering, and corruption in France. It's a very complicated case, which went all the way up to the International Court of Justice, rising into a dispute between Equatorial Guinea and France. And in rem confiscations in the U.S. also constituted like it made headlines in all major newspapers in the U.S. a few years ago. I think I'm referring back to 2014. So Obiang Mangu used to be in possession of Michael Jackson's diamond or stone covered glove. I'm sure people in the audience know, because Michael Jackson it's an icon, and we know that he used to be wearing that glove. So Obiang Mangu was in possession of that glove, but because of in rem confiscations, he couldn't explain where he got the money to purchase the glove. So the glove was confiscated by the U.S. government.
Very interesting example to finish that off. So thank you for taking us through that one and kind of the different tools that are being used in various aspects of this. It does kind of make me want to, I mean, I was planning to ask you about a different aspect of the book anyway. We've talked about labor issues. We've talked about amassing, you know, shiny things, in this case, quite literally. But also, I want to combine kind of another aspect of the book with this idea of different kinds of immunities. So you talk in one section about drug trafficking as being one of the crimes committed by elites. But I was wondering if you could maybe speak specifically in this context to how different immunities are impacted, how heads of state are treated differently from other actors with immunity when it comes to drug trafficking.
Yes. Well, this is, thank you for asking me about drug trafficking. It makes one of the chapters of the book. There's quite a lot of coverage of this topic in popular fiction, in films, action films, about criminal organizations reaching out to politicians, bribing them and asking them or tasking them with the smuggling drugs in diplomatic pouches, duffel bags across the border. So it's been shown in various films quite a lot. And obviously, popular fiction never goes too far from real life cases. And we do have, in practice, a few cases that highlight how immunity can be abused by public officials. And I actually stay more on the optimist side of things. And I show in the chapter on drug trafficking that, well, states, some governments have been able to prosecute high-level foreign public officials on drug trafficking charges in their courts. And some of those cases made history, and they were covered in other publications, but those publications don't really look at the topic of immunity. So immunity rules and laws have historically provided heads of state with a significant level of protection. The head of state immunity depends on the recognition of the state of the head of state. And I emphasize the recognition, right? If somebody is not recognized as a president of country A, country B is not going to treat that the person who acts as the president of country B will not grant immunity. So, and I don't want to make it sound complicated. I'll give an example because it will clarify things right away. So the United States government did not recognize Manuel Noriega as Panamanian president or legitimate leader, despite his de facto control of the country. And we are talking about the late 1980s here. So it's a little bit of an old case, but it's a wonderful case to illustrate my points. So the interesting part is that the U.S. accused the president of Panama at the time, Manuel Noriega, of drug trafficking activity, and because he was the serving leader of the state, even though the U.S. did not recognize him, the U.S. ordered a military intervention into Panama, which was a quite expensive thing to do under the Bush administration of the time. And he managed to hide in the embassy of Vatican for about 2 weeks in Panama. In Panama City, U.S. agents were playing rock music outside the embassy. And after 2 weeks, Manuel Noriega finally surrendered. He was escorted to the United States and he stood trial. So one of his defenses in court was that, oh, I'm the head of state. those were official acts, you cannot prosecute him. And the U.S. government, among other points, stated that, well, we never recognized you as a legitimate leader of Panama. So from the point of view of the U.S. government, there is no immunity that would be applicable here. And the same reasoning, oh, and the other point, so the country needs to recognize the head of state. And in addition to that, or a twist on this argument, the country needs to recognize the foreign state as an independent state. So if the country does not recognize the country from which the public official comes from, there would be no immunity applicable here, right? And we do have cases that actually demonstrate this. In a very recent case, featuring the Prime Minister of the British Virgin Islands, Andrew Alturo Fahey was tried in the U.S. court on drug trafficking charges, despite his official status as the Prime Minister of the Virgin Islands. And the reasoning behind the non-application of immunity in this case by a U.S. court was the British Virgin Islands is not an independent state, but an overseas territory of the U.K. Right. So, and I believe this is a very, the very creative, legally creative way of looking at the application of immunity, or actually, in this case, non-application of immunity.
It is creative. And in fact, that's what I'd like to ask you to tell us a bit more about. Are there other creative ways that you've come across in the research that you can tell us about to hold people to account?
Yeah, I guess I've already mentioned some of the ways that have become the staple in cases as we deal with the immunity questions. Unfortunately, there's not much that can be done against sitting public officials in high-ranking positions if they are protected by personal immunity. So in other words, if somebody is a legitimate foreign president recognized by states around the world, there's not much we can do while the person is in office. And we know very well that in authoritarian regimes, those people can stay in power years. Okay, literally decades. And I don't want to name and shame countries here, but some leaders have stayed in power for 36 years or 30 plus years, and there's no indication that they're going to step down. So that remains a challenge, right? But as it comes to officials with only functional immunity for official acts but not personal acts, former officials, then definitely none of the crimes covered in the book, economic crimes like corruption, drug trafficking, and trafficking in persons, can be legitimately interpreted as an official act, despite all the different attempts and reasonings that, again, state instrumentalities were used, or the person was part of the state mission, and then she or he became victimized, things like that. So those arguments are just not going to fly, or they shouldn't, right? So I guess legal scholarship should go ahead and promote the idea that corruption, drug trafficking, trafficking in persons are not official acts. They cannot be seen as official acts under any conditions. The next strong point, or the instruments, very functional instrument in the hands of law enforcement and prosecutors, is definitely non-conviction-based confiscations. I believe those hold huge potential here. Because if we are looking at economic crimes of political elites, definitely the rationale is to accumulate wealth. It's all about money, right? And if law enforcement can take this money away, that would probably weaken political elites and make them more fragile, more available for prosecution. And I think that's one of the ways to go. And interestingly, the non-conviction-based confiscation, it will work well with sitting public officials. Just going back to the problem I highlighted a minute ago, like if somebody is an acting president, right? What can you do? You cannot convict the person, but you can take the money. And this method targets the illicit process of crime directly, undermining the financial incentives for committing such crimes and offering a pathway to hold foreign political elites accountable, at least indirectly. Targeted sanctions such as the U.S. Global Magnitsky Human Rights and Accountability Act. Targeted sanctions can restrict the travel and freeze the assets of foreign officials implicated in significant corruption cases, human rights abuses, crimes like that. Those are not perfect. There is also a little bit of conversation that needs to be started on the topic of travel bans, because, let's say, according to the U.S. Agreement with the United Nations regarding the headquarters, countries cannot really stop, or the U.S. in this case, cannot prohibit foreign officials to come for a diplomatic conference, right? So there is a little bit of a caveat whether travel bans can be implemented against sitting foreign officials, because that may create some problems in some friction in diplomatic relations. But this is pretty much some of the innovative tools that we can use against deviant elites.
Thank you for taking us through them. It's very clear in listening to you kind of why you're optimistic about these possibilities, despite the challenges that remain. And hopefully you'll continue to be optimistic, I suppose, as my final question. I'd love to ask what you're working on now that this book is out there in the world for people to read.
Yeah, well, thank you. I believe I'm optimistic because of my data. So in this book, I look at court files, right? That was the most secure way, because otherwise libel issues could become an issue, or I just didn't want to write something that I don't have valid evidence for. So I looked at court files, and definitely we understand that court files, prosecutors usually go ahead with the cases that they know they can succeed in, right? So most of the court files are optimistic because they just recognize the guilt of the person. So, but I do believe that lawyers and attorneys and law enforcement officials have taken this issue seriously, particularly in the past decade or so. So I do believe that legal loopholes and inconsistencies in the application of immunity laws will be more difficult for political elites to exploit and avoid accountability. So I do see a lot of progress in this direction. So I am taking a break a little bit and looking into a new project at the moment. Also, I used to work for CUNY, for City University of New York, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and I just moved to the University of Alabama. So I take it step by step. But I am interested in looking further into issues of power and crime. And most likely, I will continue looking at accountability and globalization as it comes to how political elites move around the world, how they evade accountability, how they hide illicit wealth. So my next project will be looking at sanction evasion from the point of view of criminology, trying to understand how sanctions can be evaded, why are they evaded, what are the specific techniques from criminology and law, and then definitely looking at prevention strategies. So how can we prevent sanction evasion? How individuals involved in sanction evasion can be punished? After all, it's a recognized crime, at least in the United States and in the European Union, that comes with criminal penalties in addition to civil penalties. So it's serious. And I believe this is a wonderful topic, and it ties nicely into this book.
It really does. So that sounds like an exciting new project. Best of luck with it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And of course, while you are doing that research, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Between Immunity and Impunity, External Accountability for Political Elites for Transnational Crime, published by Cambridge University Press. Yulia, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book. And it's my best hope that the readers will find it interesting and enlightening, thought-provoking. Yes, and if there's any feedback from the readers, I would be happy to receive it. I have a public profile. It's very easy to find my email. So if anybody's interested, please reach out to me.